Before entering into the discussion of the subject of reincarnation, we feel that it is important to come to some understanding of an important conception which will be employed in that discussion. In fact, this conception is so important that it should have been included in the series of assumptions or postulates. It is the conception of the monad. By a monad, we mean the entity which proceeds forth at the beginning of any manifestation and travels, it is said, through all kingdoms of nature, ultimately entering the human kingdom and then passing on beyond into the domain which belongs to the X-Men. What is the nature of the monad? Let us think of it this way. First, that the all is a microcosm, and that in manifestation, this macrocosm reproduces itself in an enormous number of reproductions of itself, which will be called microcosms. And each microcosm strikes a particular keynote or a particular quality in which the reproduction is produced. Thus, each microcosm is the original macrocosm as it appears under the limitation of a certain quality or a certain keynote or a certain color, if you please. Nonetheless, all of the elements in the microcosm correspond to elements in the macrocosm. And every element in the macrocosm is reproduced in the microcosm, with the result that he who fully understands the microcosm which he is has a key to the understanding of the macrocosm. And that explains the importance the Greeks attached to man's knowing himself. By fully knowing himself, speaking metaphorically, man understands God. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is a place where Krishna is represented as saying, I produce this universe from an infinitesimal portion of myself, yet remain apart. Here, think of Krishna as representing the macrocosm. And what is meant here appears to be this, that the macrocosm can reproduce itself indefinitely and unlimitedly, yet remain unreduced. Is this a statement that defeats all reason as the existentialists might maintain? No. On the contrary, he who knows his mathematics finds it completely reasonable and understandable. For this, I shall use an illustration that is really very simple from the mathematics of the infinite. I have used this illustration before, but shall recall it to your memory at the present time, for it is really very simple. Consider the manifold of all the positive integers, that is 1, 2, 3, 4, on to infinity. Now, set that down as a series. And below each number, the 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth, place a second number that stands in the relationship of the double of each number. Thus, the second series would be 2 times 1, or 2, 2 times 2, or 4, 2 times 3, or 6, and so forth. We get a series that consists of all the positive integers. But we have a one-to-one relationship between the elements of each series. Corresponding to 1, there is 2 in the second series. To 2, there is 4, and to 3, there is 6. Since we have a one-to-one reciprocal relationship, we know that the cardinality of the two series is the same. The cardinality of the second series is as great as that of the first series. Yet every element in the second series is to be found in the first series. Yet in the first series, there is an infinity of elements not to be found in the second series, namely all the odd numbers, 1, 3, 5, 7, and so on. Therefore, we know that the second series is a proper part of the first. Proper part meaning that it does not have all the elements that are in the first series. But every element in the second series stands in a relationship to the first series, such that there is a one-to-one reciprocal relationship between the two, which is a definition of equal cardinality. Let the first series represent the macrocosm, the second series one example of the microcosm. Between the two, there is a transforming relationship, which in this case is the following, that every element in the second series is the double of the corresponding element in the first series. We can now derive the first series from the second by the complementary transformation of taking the halves of each element in the second series. Thus, one half of 2 is 1, one half of 4 is 2, One half of 6 is 3. One half of 4 is 8, and so on. Thus, by applying the proper transformation to the microcosm, one can derive the macrocosm. The macrocosm may be called Parabrahm, or God, or the All, or by any other designation that means the root source. But we can make other transformations. We can multiply each unit in the first series by 3, by 4, or by any other number, and get a series of which the cardinality is the same as the first series. Or we can use another relationship, such as that of taking the squares or the cubes, and so on. In fact, one may devise many transformations. Thus there is a possibility, quite obvious, that an infinite number of microcosms may be derived from the macrocosm by a certain one or another transformation. Each series will be of equal cardinality with the first series. And this suggests something that was written by Silicius Angelus. I am not less than God, and God is not more than I. And this idea remains completely rational, for it is part of the process that exists in the most rational of all sciences, namely mathematics. In fact, it is known that an infinite number of infinite series can be derived from the original infinite series without reducing the latter at all. Thus, it's perfectly reasonable for Krishna to say, I produce this universe from an infinitesimal portion of myself, and yet remain apart. Now, it has been said that each microcosmic monad must pass through every kingdom of nature. That means through the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, into the human, and beyond the human, and possibly through unknown kingdoms preceding the mineral. There's a question here. What does this mean? Do the kingdoms of nature exist apart from the All, and that the journey of the monads is projected into it? But in that case, it would not be the All, for nature would be left out. Perhaps we may see it this way, that nature itself is a complex of microcosmic monads. Yet each monad must pass through this complex. So it's a movement of monads with respect to other monads. Here we come into one of those situations where we inevitably are involved in paradoxes. Let us leave that alone for the present. There remains something for us to yet understand in the future. The journey of the monads through all kingdoms of nature is not yet the meaning of reincarnation, which applies to a special stage, namely that when we come to man. It is said that in this process, below the level of man, the individual entities, like the animals, the plants, and the specific rocks, are not themselves reincarnated as individuals, but that, as it were, that which they have learned from experience is drawn back into the collective soul of the species. Perhaps in a way, a given species is itself the monad rather than the individual entities, like the specific rocks, the different plants, or the different individual animals. And that in this stage, there is no freedom. We have determination by law without freedom. Freedom comes only at the stage of the human evolution. Here, for the first time, there appears the development of that, of individuation in each individual. Perhaps we might think of this as a stage where we have a secondary order of microcosms, namely microcosms of the main microcosm, which in its term is a microcosm of the macrocosm. However that may be, let us now proceed to the consideration of reincarnation as it applies to the evolution of men. We have pictured so far a process of the monads passing through all kingdoms of nature. And it's very doubtful that we could identify a single human being as having passed through the state of a rock and of a vegetable and of an animal, but rather that there was a collective transmigration of the monads through these kingdoms, and that reincarnation begins only when the stage of reason has been reached and man becomes in greater or less degree a free entity. In the beginning, in the primitive, limited in his freedom. But when he becomes a full Buddha, possessing maximum freedom. At what point in the evolution does the reincarnation of the individual entity begin? Is it perhaps at the point that is designated by the classifications of our biologists? Man is classified as a species under the general classification of the primates. And the primates, in their turn, are classified as a subdivision of the mammals, and so forth. Thus, man is conceived as merely another animal. This we find very questionable. Man is in part a biological entity and has a certain commonality with other biological entities, as the primates and the mammals, and even other forms of life that are more humble or more elemental in the scale of being. But that is not the whole of the story. He is also a mental being, an entity of consciousness. And in our opinion, we will have more success in finding the critical moment when reincarnation begins by regarding him as a mental entity superimposed upon an animal vehicle. To throw a bit of light upon this position, I'll direct your attention to a certain statement to be found in The Secret Doctrine. In the story of evolution, as given in The Secret Doctrine, there is a certain event that is of striking importance. It is called the descent of the Manasa Putra. While with our present resources, we are unable to verify the correctness of this statement, it is claimed that it is known by certain men who have evolved powers of the psyche far beyond that which is common to us as human beings, although said to be potential in all of us, and that it is through the researches of these men that this knowledge has been attained. For the purposes of our presentation here, we will assume the correctness of this statement. And in fact, if we assume it, a great deal becomes clear that otherwise would remain obscure. It is said that man became at one time the recipient of a descent of other entities who carried the mental principle. These entities are said to have been a certain class of Dianjuans who had made some error in their own development that involved what might be called a karmic fall. That the error was of such a nature that it would not be comprehensible to our ordinary intelligence. However that may be, let us assume all this, and that the penalty was, it is said, of the nature that this body of fallen Dianjuans had to incarnate themselves in the human animal when he had reached the point of nascent man. In other words, the evolution heretofore had been autonomous from the rock, through the vegetable, through the animal, to nascent man when the animal was at the edge of becoming human, but not yet human. They were said to be ape-like creatures, but not what we call apes today. When these members of the fallen Dehanchoans faced this karmic obligation, it is said, some incarnated at once, others rejected the idea and only projected a ray of themselves into these ape-like creatures, and still others only overshadowed. In other words, it appears that there was a certain repulsion at the idea of occupying the vehicles of ape-like creatures. But by this means, the principle of mind, in the true sense that differentiates the mind of man from the mind of the animal, was introduced into these ape-like creatures, and that from that point on we have the true evolution of man, and that now it is not simply evolution as an autonomous process in nature, but an evolution guided by the principle of mind. This implies that man is not merely another animal, another genus and species, but rather that he is a mental being which occupies an animal vehicle. And as a compound, he has both mental characteristics and animal characteristics, and he may identify himself with either. If he is foolish, he will identify himself with the animal and indulge animal propensities. But if he is wise, he will look upon himself as a mental being, occupying an animal body, and hold himself in ascension above that animal body, commanding it and not permitting it to dominate with its animal propensities. As we look across the world, it would appear that most human beings have made their identification with the animal, and that may be the cause of the unhappy condition we find in this world today. In reality, we are not animals, but fallen Dehanchoans climbing again. Now in this account, it is said that not all of the ape-like creatures received the incarnation of the Manasaputra or the fallen Dhyanchand. And two racial groups are mentioned who did not receive this incarnation, they being not sufficiently advanced. These were the natives of Australia and the Bushmen of Africa. But it is implied that there were others also. Now we come to the point that I want to make. It seems more reasonable to believe that the principle of reason, and therefore that which makes freedom possible, begins with the incarnation of the Dhyanchands. And therefore, it is at this point that reincarnation of the individual begins. And therefore, it would be implied that individual incarnation does not apply to those races which did not have the incarnation of the Dhyanchand or Manasaputra. This is our suggestion. There is no other authority for it, but it's put forth for what it may be worth. Now we will proceed to give a sketch of what may be the essential process of reincarnation. As we enter upon the discussion of the subject of reincarnation, it is important to note that there has been a great deal of misunderstanding of just what it is that is reincarnated. It is not the physical personality of the individual that we have known here. The John Smith of today does not become the Eric Koons of tomorrow and a continuation of that same physical personality. It is more complicated than that. And to come to a somewhat more comprehensive understanding of this subject, I shall refer to a suggestion which I made some years ago in a lecture before an academic class. It was called the pseudopodal theory of reincarnation. The image of the pseudopod is taken from the amoeba. The amoeba is a primitive one-celled creature, I think an animal, that crawls by means of projecting a portion of its body forward so that it appears like a limb, an arm, for instance, and then draws back that, so advancing, then projects outward another portion of its body as another apparent arm, and so on. These are called pseudopods. Pseudo because they are not permanent limbs, definitely organized, like the limbs of the mammals, but apparent limbs that are projected and then disappear. Now I shall use the figure of the pseudopod to represent the monad. The monad then from time to time, projects a portion of itself into outer incarnation. And that is what we call the human being that appears here and has his concrete personal life in this world. Later, that particular projection is withdrawn by the event which men call death and is reassimilated into the persistent monad. Then after an elapse of time in which the projected individual goes through his after-death experiences, which it is said involves a period in what is called Devakan, which is a state of consciousness that is delightful and in general is much longer in time than that in which the outer life experience took place. Then when everything has been assimilated, the seeds of which were sown in the outer life, there comes a time when the impulse to go forth again takes place. Now, what goes forth again is another pseudopod, as it were, of the monad. And this pseudopod is the karmic heir of the first pseudopod. It is a continuation, in one sense, of the first pseudopod, in that it is the karmic heir. But it is not the specific personal identity of the original first projection. Now certain things we can see would take place. First of all, not everything that makes up the total meaning and character of the monad is projected into any one incarnation, but probably only a very small portion of that total meaning of the monad. Since certain qualities are put forth in any given lifetime, and certain other qualities are held back, the probability is that a succeeding incarnation would consist of the qualities that were relatively repressed in the preceding incarnation. And thus, we would have an individual that might appear quite different from the individual of the preceding incarnation. It would take a deep and trained insight to recognize the identity of the two. Thus, a given individual might have an incarnation in which he developed the power of thought to a high degree and became an important philosopher, but at the price of a relative depreciation or denial of the feeling side of his total nature. It would be this feeling side which then would tend to be the quality most emphasized in an immediately succeeding incarnation. And one observing the two individuals might find it difficult to identify them as coming from the same entity, or rather as representing the same monadic entity. And this might continue over a wide range of qualities. Thus, in each particular incarnation, there would be only a limited manifestation of the total resources of the monad. Some of those resources might be in a latent form that had not yet been developed explicitly, or they might be in a highly developed form and yet held back, since in this given incarnation certain qualities were to be specifically and concentratedly developed. This process serves the purpose of developing explicitly the hidden resources of the monad, until the cycle of manness is completed. In that process, there would come a time when new resources or powers of consciousness could break forth, the preparation having been completed over a long series of lives as reincarnations. When this occurs, the hour may strike for the breakthrough to another form of consciousness. This has specific bearings upon that step which is called the breakthrough to enlightenment, realization, awakening, or the development of cosmic consciousness. Our work is specifically oriented to the advancement of this development. It is not primarily oriented to the particular needs of those individuals in the world who are not yet ready for this unfoldment. The fourth assumption is to the effect that all monads are obligated to pass through all kingdoms of nature. This we have already in some degree discussed under the heading of reincarnation, and it will therefore not be necessary to go further into this subject at this time. But here a point comes up. It is not possible to handle each of these elements or principles in isolation from the balance of all the principles, for they are interconnected, and we may say that it is impossible completely to understand any one of the principles without first understanding all. And likewise, we cannot understand all without first understanding each principle. This looks as though it were an impossible task, and is one of the mysteries involved when we are dealing with a holistic position. In dealing with partial portions of the existent about us, we may be definitive and proceed step by step But when we deal with the whole, or orient ourselves to the whole, we face a different set of problems where it is never possible to understand fully the part without ultimately dealing with the holistic view. Basically, this is illustrated in the principle that in all our ordinary cognition, the knower stands as though apart from the known, and he can deal with it as though contained in forms that are apparently definitive. But dealing with any ultimate question, we have the fusion of the knower and the known and the knowledge in one whole. And this leads to the typical situation where paradoxes arise. The fifth postulate concerns the thesis that the process of evolution in relative consciousness is in the form of progressive breakthroughs to more advanced stages of consciousness. In Morris Buck's Cosmic Consciousness, the suggestion has been made that we can start with the consciousness of the animal, step to the normal human consciousness, and from that to cosmic consciousness. There, the consciousness of the animal is called simple consciousness. That of man, self-consciousness, and that of the enlightened or realized or those who have cosmic consciousness as this other kind of luminous consciousness. The simple consciousness of the animal is conceived as being in the form of sense perception, the familiar form which is known to all human beings also, as in part man has an animal nature. But it is also conceived that it reaches up into that which is called the recept, or the generic image. This would imply that the animal has more than merely meaningless sense impressions, but can identify them, can distinguish between a tree, for instance, and a rock, as a kind of semi-generalized notion. Of course, here we're dealing with speculation in considerable measure, but we do have the opportunity to analyze this phase of consciousness by studying our sensuous nature and its progressions. We have in our work employed a somewhat different classification. The orientation here has been to the cognitive function, and the identification has taken this form, that in the lowest, most primitive form, it is sensuous cognition. That is, cognition through the physical senses. And this has often been called the aesthetic component. The next, identified with the preeminently human or man stage, is identified with conceptual cognition. The distinction between these two may be made rather simply in this way, that sensuous cognition gives us concrete particulars, just precisely that which we see or otherwise sense as concrete particulars. Whereas in contrast, the conceptual cognition essentially is oriented to universals, not to a tree, but to tree-ness, and so on, to all the different categories of our experience. It has been evident to us that there's a radical step involved here. One does not reach from sensuous cognition to conceptual cognition by a larger and larger growth in sensuous cognition, but something is added on, something precipitated that is of a different nature. There is a suggestion given in the Eastern thought that may be helpful here. It has been developed by Sri Aurobindo by introducing the theory of avataral descent. When a new function is to be introduced into the world, an aspect of the divine, as it were, descends and pioneers the new step, so that you have, in the series of avatars, one that's called the fish avatar, and so on up the line. Now, if the nascent human had reached the point where the next step was ready to be taken, the theory would involve the idea that the divine descends and introduces the conceptual function into the nascent human being. Now, we have already considered this in an earlier portion of this discourse and identified this step with the descent of the Manasa Putra, thus bringing in to the nascent human being, who is little more than an animal, a new function, a new power of consciousness. Now then, we come to the third step. When the evolution of the human entity, who is now a conceptual and a sensuous being, has reached a sufficient degree of maturity, it would be possible for a third function, faculty, or principle of consciousness to be awakened or to be introduced into his total constitution. This I have called introceptual consciousness, and it is characterized by the quality knowledge through identity, a mode of conception where the known is no longer separated from the knower as something distinct and out there, as it were, separate from myself as the knower, but rather a state where these two are fused, and one knows by being identical with the known. This does not give knowledge in the conceptual sense, the kind of knowledge which leads to speech and all forms of written or verbal communication, including the communication through signs and symbols, but is known in another way and can only be communicated by a process of transcription such that the immediate material of interoceptual cognition is transformed into a conceptual statement involving inevitably distortion, since the pattern or style of conceptual cognition does not fit it, yet nonetheless communicating something of the value of the interoceptual cognition. A communication of value, of something of truth, along with an unavoidable element of distortion.